Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, episode 2432 of The Tom Woods Show, joined by the great James Bovard, who has written, I don't know, probably somewhere in the vicinity of 817 books. He's been published everywhere. New York Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New Republic, The American Conservative, all over the place. You can find his new book in the various places you find books these days. And that is Last Rights, The Death of American Liberty. Now, Last Rights, of course, is in a way, of course, a play on words, but it's also a play on a much earlier book by Jim called Lost Rights. And so now we've reached 2023 and the book is called Last Rights. Well, welcome back, Jim.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. Thanks for your kind words.
Absolutely, my pleasure. So let's dig in here. We've got a lot of detailed stuff. And you know, if you pick up a book by old Bovard, it is not going to be full of glittering generalities. He gets right down into the details of topic after topic and anecdote after anecdote and story and illustration. It is all in there, packed in there. And so I picked out a bunch of things that I jotted down that I want to talk about. But rest assured, there is 800 billion times more supporting evidence and more topics covered than we're going to get to here. I want to point out that Jim and I were supposed to record this episode yesterday. And I had to write to him and say, we have to put it off for a day because, to make a long story short, we have a cat, our dear Miles Matheson, who has had a history of urinary blockages. And so he eats a special kind of food. Well, we couldn't get him extra food, which he needs because he hasn't been seen by a vet in X number of months. And they have to sign off on this, even though they've all said this food is a lifelong regimen for him. They've already said that. So we couldn't get him the food unless we rushed him into a vet, which we had to do yesterday to get him the food. So I said, Jim, isn't it fitting that our episode talking about stupid regulations has to be postponed because of a stupid regulation? So there we are, Jim. That's America 2023.
Well, it's good you'll get your cat to the vet and get that get the sign off that it's complete BS. It was necessary, but you know, that's kind of like the storyline of modern life.
Yeah, isn't it? Everything's criminalized. I think you quoted Neil Gorsuch early in your book
You know, I was so happy to find that quote from the Supreme Court justice because some people think I'm radical. But no, so I have a quote from him. I even had a quote from my favorite liberal justice, Mayor Ginsburg, and folks like that. But it's fascinating that people are recognizing that, yeah, the government has criminalized everything. Unfortunately, a lot of people think that's a good idea nowadays.
Right. That is rather the problem. But yeah, of course, well, Mr. Moderate Jim Bovard quoting Supreme Court justices. What is your problem with old Jim? All right. I want to start with a topic that might seem kind of boring or kind of, especially to more radical libertarians, but doggone it, it has to be talked about. And I want to focus on it also because my wife and I were just talking about this the other day. Civil asset forfeiture. But in particular, I want to start off talking about the dogs who sniff and when they bark or whatever the heck they do, then that's probable cause for the human beings to go through your stuff. Well, Jim, I never gave this a second thought. And then the other day, I was talking to my wife and she said, you know, I have a funny feeling about these dogs. I have a feeling that they are not all they're cracked up to be, but people think they are, and then they're just pretext to go through your stuff. And she says that some years ago in the town she was living in, there was a police dog whom everybody affectionately knew as Cheeseburger. So they had this cute little name to put one over on the rubes. And she said, everybody else was saying, oh, I love Cheeseburger. And she was saying, but I was thinking to myself, Cheeseburger is going to F up your life. So what's the real story with dogs like Cheeseburger?
Yeah, it sounds like your wife is very savvy on this. I wish more Americans were as savvy as your wife. Yeah, I mean, so these dogs are basically search warrants on a leash. And there's so much deference given to them. The Supreme Court has repeatedly sprinkled their holy water over the dog alerts, even though it's, as your wife said, it's probably a bunch of crap. I mean, it's so biased that there was one police department that just cut to the chase and named this dog guilty. So because I mean, anybody that they stopped, yep, that person was guilty. And the police and the feds have known for 30 years that the vast majority of American currency has some micro taint of narcotics, cocaine or whatever. And so, but what the government has kept on doing is if the government stops you and you've got a couple $100 in cash or even a couple dozen bills, the government can bring in the drug dog and the drug dog alerts, and that's sufficient for the government to confiscate the money. And then it's up to you to hire a lawyer and to get down and beg and plead. Maybe the government will give you back some of the money if you agreed not to sue.
All right, well, let's talk about the more general issue of civilized authority. That dog thing was just so interesting because we had just been talking about it. And I had never thought about that. I mean, and I'm very skeptical and cynical. I had never even thought there might be something.
Not enough.
That's why I have you on, Jim. And then when I saw it in your book, I actually took a picture of the, we won't tell the publisher, the Libertarian Institute, not that they would care. I took a picture of that page and I sent it to her. I said, we were just talking about this. But I want to talk about civil asset forfeiture more generally, because from what I understand, maybe you can explain it to me. Is it a matter of if there's a suspicion that I've been involved in wrongdoing, do I have the burden of proof of showing that I haven't been engaged in wrongdoing in order to get my property back? Or am I misunderstanding that?
That's basically correct. And a huge problem here is the government needs no evidence to confiscate your property. There was a really good Washington Post series on the DEA and what they were doing. And DEA was searching the luggage at the airports, and the DEA would go in there and find if someone had a bunch of cash in their suitcase. DEA would simply leave a note saying the cash was seized by the DEA and take the money. That was the extent of the due process. And somebody would have to sue and fight to get a long drawn out battle that's completely biased in the government's favor in order to try to get that back. And it's interesting to see some of the court cases on this, on the notion of innocent owner, because one of the landmark cases came up in 1996. It was based on a steel worker who was driving home from work and picked up a prostitute in Detroit parked on the street. The police in Detroit came up, caught her in the act, and the car was seized. And there was a big dispute on that, in part because the car was co-owned by the steel worker's wife, Tina Bennis. She was very unhappy. But it was a perfect case for the government to explain what it all meant. And the Chief Justice upheld that case based on the comparison, the parallel of a pirate ship that was seized in 1822. And so he didn't explain how piracy in the 1820s became equivalent to fill in the blank in the 1990s. But it's almost like an alternate universe, and certainly an alternate moral universe, in which the government has these principles and precedents which can completely destroy property rights and leave people up the boat without a paddle, or vice versa. And you got a lot of justices, Justice Thomas, Judge Willett, a lot of liberals have pointed out that poor people, low-income people, are the ones most likely to be victimized because they have the least ability to fight back.
I want to find, I remember page 23.
Yes, that was the good one.
Well, I have a big circle. Let's see if I can get it on the camera the right way on there. But this paragraph, barely 1% of property seized by the feds is ever returned, in part because the recovery process is hellishly complex. The feds have gone to bizarre lengths to assure that forfeiture remains inscrutable. In 2004, the Justice Department ordered hundreds of federal depository libraries around the nation to remove and destroy its publications titled Civil and Criminal Forfeiture Procedure, Select Criminal Forfeiture Forms, and Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering Resource Directory. The outlawed documents, quote, include information on how citizens can retrieve items that may have been confiscated by the government during an investigation, unquote, protested American Library Association President Michael Gorman. The Justice Department canceled the bonfires after the Mutiny of the Librarians. Now, by the way, wouldn't that be a great movie, The Mutiny of the Librarians? But that.
Yes, indeed.
I had heard before that it is not an easy process to navigate your way through, but I had not known that there was at least a lackluster campaign to actually take the books away.
It's fascinating to see the government sense of its own power and superiority over the American citizens. Because first you rob people, and then you beg it, almost impossible for them to get justice. And then you go and burn the books. And it's like, okay, what are they going to do next? And the next thing which they did was that National Lampoon dog video.
What's that?
This is a video that the FBI put out a few years ago, and it was showing dogs that had been rescued, and the FBI was claiming that they had to be able to do civil asset forfeiture in order to save these dogs. And somebody joked on Twitter that the message of the FBI was that people had to surrender the Fifth Amendment or the dog dies. But there's another wrinkle to that, and what the FBI did tell people was that prior to very recently, the FBI would go in and rescue dogs. There were dog fighting operations and stuff like that. And the government would simply kill the dogs to save the money of upkeep.
There's quite a record of government killing dogs.
Yeah.
It seems.
Yes.
Holy
it's
cow.
It's become a little fashionable, yes.
Yeah, and I think Fauci also had some, ran some experiments of us.
Oh my God. He was, barbaric. And I had so much respect for him.
Yeah, you know, up until that moment, it was interesting to see people for the ethical treatment of animals, even during COVID, criticizing Fauci for that. They were like the only, I mean, you could say maybe the LGBT people would be critical of him because of his record during AIDS, which they were critical of him like 5 years ago, but not anymore. We no longer have any self-respect, but the animal people, they had enough self-respect to stand up against Fauci. The ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, goes back to George H.W. Bush. And I think when most people hear about it, they think that this just means we're going to try to install wheelchair ramps and things like that, right? Wouldn't you agree? Most people probably think that that's just what it is. And yeah, it's an expense, but as a decent society, it's an expense we have to take on. But in your book, we have rather more, shall we say, unusual aspects of the ADA coming to the fore.
Yeah, well, there were some colorful examples. One of my favorite cases was a deaf guy who was suing Pornhub because most of the videos on Pornhub don't have closed captions. So there was, I'm trying to recall the name of the movie that he cited. There was something about a hot aunt tries to discipline her nephew, and it didn't have closed captions. So he wasn't able to fully appreciate the movie, and therefore he claimed that his rights have been violated under the Disabilities Act.
But then there are cases of a coat, I think it was California restaurant, with the coat hook was too high.
Yes, I mean, what's happened is that California's got one of the worst laws in the nation to supplement the ADA. But the law has encouraged people to go around and file meritless complaints. And there was a disability activist who's on one of the state panels down in Florida, he was pointing out it's been completely counterproductive because it means that if people see someone coming in who looks like they're in a wheelchair or they've got some kind of disability, they instantly fear there's going to be a lawsuit or some kind of BS complaint. And it's unfortunate because Americans in the last few decades have become a lot more reasonable and humane as far as their attitude towards the disabled and handicapped. But you have all these lawsuits, over 500,000 lawsuits, thanks to this law, and it just creates very perverse incentives.
Well, I think, for example, if you consider that disability is a continuum, some people have very severe disabilities, others have very mild ones. So if it's a matter of, I'm going to get in trouble if I haven't hired, let's say, a certain number of disabled people, well, I'll just hire the ones who have a cleft palate or something, rather than the ones who have severe disabilities who now are even worse off.
Yeah, part of the goal of the Disabilities Act was to close the gap for employment, but there's a higher rate of unemployment among the disabled now than before the law was enacted. And a huge problem is that the law has turned disabilities into legal assets. And so that has proliferated a lot among, like, for instance, college students. College students can claim to have some type of mental or emotional disability, and therefore get twice as much time to take a test or to claim other accommodations. And the colleges know the feds are waiting to sue them if they don't give accommodations to practically everybody who claims to have a disability. So in some of the more prestigious colleges, you've got like a third of the students claiming to have a disability.
Yeah. Brief but important message from Ol Woods here. Hundreds, if not thousands, of my readers are joining me in something pretty darn exciting next month, and I'd like you to be one of them. We are going to make 2024 the best year any of us have ever had. We're not going to do that by thinking positive or wishing or hoping or, heaven help us, with feckless New Year's resolutions. We're going to be following my system, which involves none of those useless things. This system has taken me from my very lowest point to having exactly the life I want in terms of finances, relationships, health, hobbies, work-life balance, the whole package. I didn't get there at random or by drifting along. If you drift along, you can expect drift-along results. I got there instead by following the specific, no-fluff, step-by-step program that has given me a better life than I could ever have expected. I want you to have results like that, and you can. Do this alongside me. If you sit down and complete the exercises by the end of January 2024, you can ask me for your money back, and I'll gladly give it to you. If I told you I was giving you a free goal-setting program, nobody would do it, trust me. But since this is the first time I'm ever offering this, you have no testimonials to go on. You just have to trust me. So to lower your risk to virtually zero, I've added that feature. Just complete it, and you can have your money back if you choose. How's that for an offer? Get ready to write me a note in 2024 expressing astonishment at how much your life has changed for the better. You can go through the program at your leisure. There'll be only one live session, an optional orientation with me on January 2nd. Now, you may be skeptical. I completely understand. If I hadn't done this myself, I would be the same way. But just wait and see. You will be sending me that note. Next December, my homepage for this site will consist almost entirely of testimonials. Now, naturally, if your life is already fulfilling and satisfying in every area, this isn't for you. But if you're a human like the rest of us, it is. As we head into 2024, let's do something thrilling together. The website, 2024crusher.com. You know, there are a lot of these three-letter agencies that you have followed for quite some time. So the ADA is not an agency, but it's, let's say, a three-letter piece of legislation. But I used to think when libertarians would focus on things like the TSA, I would think, oh, this is so frivolous compared to the big, big issues that we could be focusing on. But I feel like there's enough of us that some of us can focus on some things and some on others. There's, you know, there's something for everybody to do. And recently, I had a little bit of an episode with the TSA because I travel a lot and I travel with my kids. And I, you know, maybe I'll get criticized for this. I really, frankly, don't care. But I want to make the travel process as comfortable as I can for me and for my kids. So I have pre-check and I have clear. And so usually we just sail right through. Nobody bothers us. But to make a long story short, I was bringing my 13-year-old and she had a credit that we were using with Delta. And it's a long story that in order to redeem it, she was on a separate reservation from me, whatever. So my pre-check wasn't going to carry over to her. And it was a long story. So the rest of the family, no problem. I went through the standard security with her. And doggone it, wouldn't you know, they wanted to examine her further. It's a 13-year-old kid. Now, thankfully, it was not particularly invasive. But I just thought, I can't believe I'm letting this happen. So I stood there, and as they're about to do this, I'm saying, Elizabeth, I want you to know that they do this entirely for theater. It accomplishes nothing. They don't prevent anything. And that time after time, when teams of experts have come through here to try to trick them, 95% of the time they get through with a weapon. And they're going to waste their time going after you. That's what you need to understand about all government agencies. They're all like this. And the TSA woman is saying, sir, you can tell that to my supervisor if you like. And I said, I wasn't talking to you. Am I allowed to talk to my daughter? And so as we walked away, she understood. And I showed her, I dug it up on my phone, Ron Paul standing up in the House of Representatives, giving that speech about how they're fattening us up and they're going to eat us. And we've got to push back against this and all. She got a little lesson that particular day.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the effectiveness of the TSA.
Well, it's always been a joke. It's been a joke going back ever since it was created. And as you mentioned, it failed 95% of the undercover tests where the inspector general people or the red team were smuggling mock weapons or guns through there. But what the TSA does each time there's a huge embarrassment like that is crack down further on average American travelers. TSA officials have admitted that there's no reason for the vast majority of travelers to be treated as any type of threat. But it's like the system feeds on its own paranoia, or it needs a certain number of search victims in order to justify its existence. I was traveling through Nashville Airport in September, and I was wearing jeans, and I was doing standard go-through. And I was, you know, I tried to be a good American. I was a Boy Scout. You know, I always try to obey the rules. I don't try too hard. But so I take off my boots, I take off my belt, I empty my pocket, and it's like, okay, so I walk through, I raise my hands like I'm on a being searched by the police, get through there, and some guys would, you're going to do a subliminal pat down. And I said, well, what's this about? And so he shows me this big screen, and there was a very narrow area right in front of my groin that had lit up on the screen as problematic. And I looked at it, I said, that's my zipper. Yeah, well, we're going to do a supplemental. And so this big galoot of a guy starts to grab my ankles real hard. And I've got, you know, I flatter myself, it's not that long. So anyhow.
Well, Jim, I have, this will be TSA story day. This was about 20 years ago. I don't remember where I was coming back from, but on a return flight, they found a steak knife in my briefcase. And the reason it was there is that the day I had gone on the initial trip, I had brought some leftover food from home to eat in my office. And I had must have just put it all, because that is normally what I would do with it, to bring it home. And I thought, oh my gosh, how do I explain this? I mean, it helped that it, you know, there was encrusted food on it or whatever. But oh, they went up one side, down the other. I mean, it's 20 years. I don't remember all the details, but I was detained and they, you know, nothing ultimately happened to me. But at that moment, I realized, wait a minute, they're only catching this on the return flight. I walked through the TSA with all the machinery and the pat downs and whatever it is that they've got at their disposal with a knife, no problem. I had gone through with a knife with no problem.
It happens all the time. I mean, one of my most vivid stories was I was coming back from Portland, Oregon on Thanksgiving Day, 2015, and I'd made the mistake of using hand sanitizer before I went into the checkpoint. The hand sanitizer has glycerin, which the TSA, based on their very sophisticated tests, treats that as a warning of an explosive.
Oh.
So I got this huge extra stuff, a little pat down. You know, there's this TSA agent basically trying to turn my family jewels into a pancake. But I did a USA Today story on that, my intimate experience, two intimate experiences with TSA, did some FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, got some of their memos, got the video from the first part of the searches, and it made a fun story.
You know, with a book like yours, and again, what did I do with it? Here.
It's got to be there at some place.
That's right. Last rites.
You know, where the hell is the, you know, life story?
Well, I'm more or less keeping this thing in order, although if there's disorder, it's not within the frame. We'll put it that way.
Right.
But again, talking about last rites here, this is, as with other books of yours that I've read, it covers so much in so many different areas that I want to cover just a little bit of a whole bunch of things. So, of course, there's a section in here on housing because government has screwed that up, and I've written about that myself. But there's a particular...
There's a book you did on that that was the best New York Times bestseller, right?
Thank you, Jim. Meltdown, which would be somewhere on the shelf behind there. That's right. Well, you have a section, though, about something called Section 8. And
yes.
We all hear Section 8 over and over and over. But I don't think anybody knows exactly what's in Section 8 because no one's read it. So what does that actually mean? And what are some of the problems associated with it?
Section 8 is a rental subsidy, federal rental subsidy program created in the late 1974. It expanded pretty quickly. And it's become a synonym for urban problems or shifting the urban problems to the suburbs. There have been some studies that show a high correlation between Section 8 and a higher homicide rate. There are areas where what the government does is give out vouchers, and people can take these vouchers and then rent an apartment or house wherever they please, just as long as the price isn't too high. But the level for these Section 8 vouchers is a lot higher than what most Americans pay for rent. And you've had a lot of trouble in areas where they were linked to crime. Housing and Urban Development Agency did a big study to see the impact of the Section 8 on the recipients. Didn't look at the effect on the neighbors. But one of the things that came out was there was a huge increase in crime by young people and the families of that. There was a study in Chicago that showed thousands of crimes, violent crimes at Section 8 addresses. The government tended to be very secretive as far as some of the real problems of the program, but it's come out. And there was even a rap band in D.C. for a while that called itself Section 8 Law. It's kind of like, you know, you wonder how the program gets a rap.
I just realized, by the way, if I can back up a bit, I forgot to ask you something I wanted to ask you about TSA. Okay. If somebody said, all right, Mr. Smart Guy Libertarian, I understand that the TSA has its problems, but look, there are bad actors in the world and I don't want them flying on planes. So if you're so smart, what do you recommend?
Privatizing airport security like they do in Canada, like they do in most Western European nations. There's no reason that the person who scans you needs to be a federal agent, because there's a huge issue that federal agents tend to have sovereign immunity. And so it doesn't matter if they grab you or, you know, when I was doing some stories on TSA, right around the time of Kavanaugh, his Supreme Court nomination, and there were the allegations of him sexually abusing a young woman, a young girl. So what I did is did some searches on Twitter on TSA, just searching TSA and the names of various female anatomy. And there was this tidal wave of complaints from women who felt like they had been molested by TSA at checkpoints. But there was no legal recourse, because the Justice Department of TSA were claiming that the TSA agents had immunity. That is starting to crumble. There have been two federal appeals courts that have basically turned that down. And now the TSA is actually going to have to justify its groping, and that could go badly.
You know, I was just writing today about I'm jumping to yet another thing. This is a lightning, the whole interview is a lightning round, Jim.
That's fine.
It's a stream of consciousness episode of the Tom Woods Show. I was writing about, now, by the time this airs, this might have been resolved, but the mayor of Chicago announced, contrary to his campaign promise, there's a surprise, that he is in fact looking to move against some of these selective schools in the city that people, students who are particularly academically gifted, can place into. And it was a way, I think, to prevent families from leaving the city, because at least it gives them one thing. You have a decent school you can send your kids to. But this is not good for equity, quote unquote. So therefore, so much the worse for your schools. We're going to fight against them. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, we had the little gifted and talented program, and it wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good. I mean, I would have been bored without it. Like, it really helped me, but it's not egalitarian. And I think as I read your section on education, I don't remember if this came up, but this is, it's like there's a deliberate attack on everything that involves merit and excellence and striving. And so it's like, even when you're a parent who thinks, well, I know the schools aren't great, but in this city, I've got this one good one. You know what? They're coming for that one. That one that you found that's pretty good, they're coming for that one. The ones that are an absolute disaster, well, those will just continue forever. But the ones that might actually be delivering a good product, that actually do cater to ambitious kids, those are the ones that'll be in the crosshairs.
Yeah, and it's interesting in Chicago, because my understanding is what they're doing there is paying lavishly to maintain a bunch of empty school buildings, because the school enrollment has collapsed there. But the situation, as far as on the gifted programs, that epitomizes how the politicians, the teacher unions, and the education bureaucrats feel like they have a right to stifle young people for reaching their full mental potential. Because it's obvious, if you put everybody, hold them to the same level, it's a huge thing out there in California right now with them dumbing down the math standards, just appalling. But the people who are running the governance schools don't care about individuals. And it's up to the parents and the individual kids to make sure that they find a way to ignite their own mind. Because the government schools aren't going to do that, because it's all about leveling and having folks turned down in some, right now it's so much about indoctrination. There is a section of the book that talks about the schools have become, the school association, teacher associations have become missionaries who are like they're trying to cure or fix barbarians but from their American, average American values. And there's so much indoctrination. It's horrendous how the schools are encouraging kids starting in kindergarten to doubt their own gender and torment themselves about things which should never be an issue in school.
And of course, these days we're seeing on social media, we're reading about young people who feel discouraged. They feel despair. They feel like everything's too expensive. Everything's out of their reach. The kinds of things that you want to have as you're growing up and becoming an adult. I mean, eventually you want your own house. You want all these various things that seem increasingly to be out of reach. And then we hear stories of people feeling like they have to work too hard and they have undesirable jobs. But the thing is, almost all of these people have gone through the government schools their entire lives. And yet, although they know that molten rock is called magma, nobody has bothered to prepare them for what the 21st century economy looks like.
Even worse than that is a set of attitudes which a lot of the kids have imbued from the schools, from the tenured government employees who stand there and drone in front of them for X number of hours a day and just stupefy their minds. Looking back on my own time, I mean, most of my time in government school was in a small southern town that was really good folks, but not, you know, it wasn't dynamic. And I was never aware that it would be up to me in life to get my mind going as fast as I could, as strong as I could, in order to be able to survive and thrive. I mean, that simply never showed up on the radar. Instead, you were just herded from one class to the next, and as long as you did it okay, it was like, okay, you know, you get your piece of paper at the end.
Let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, DeleteMe. I'm very fortunate to have an audience who does not need to have it explained to them why data privacy online is important, but it's become more urgent than ever in recent months. So yes, of course we want to avoid identity theft, and we have other concerns too, but now the potential for doxing and harassment, and even worse, has suddenly become much more dire. For instance, we've seen jurors connected to Trump cases having personal information about their families spread. The conflict between Israel and Hamas has likewise resulted in targeting of people on both sides. And here's the kicker. People on the other side of an argument from you can generally find your private personal details. 98% of U.S. citizens can have private details uncovered by data brokers. So understand, angry, politically polarized individuals are now able to find private personal details from data brokers on 98% of U.S. citizens. DeleteMe research shows the volume of personal data on individuals available online has tripled between 2019 and 2023 to an average of over 525 pieces of personal info per person, available for free or for as little as $5 per profile. Do you want a trove of personal data being weaponized and shared? That could take the form not just of harassment, but also spoofing or reputational attacks, targeting of your family members, you name it. Well, DeleteMe comes to the rescue. Data that you don't want out there, it'll get removed. The process is super simple. I know because I've done it myself. I submitted my personal information that I wanted removed from search engines and data broker sites. DeleteMe's experts find and remove it. Within 7 days, I receive a detailed report from DeleteMe. Simple and effective. Now, because you know old Woods here, you can get 20% off all consumer plans by going to joindeleteme.com/woods and using coupon code, wait for it, Woods at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/woods, code Woods at checkout. Let's talk about, let's say, another barrier to people that, again, as with so many barriers, a lot of people think are benign, which involves occupational licensing. Most people don't give this a second thought. And if they do, they think, well, this was established to keep me safe from quack doctors or bad hairdressers or whatever, bad flower arrangers, because there are licensing requirements in some states for flower arranging. What's the real story here? And is this really a big obstacle? I mean, of course, the African hair braiding example is generally given, but what else do we have?
Well, it's something which is expanding in a lot of areas. There was the state of Virginia recently mandated that art therapists have to have a government license. And I guess they were worried about children in the art therapy class and throwing balls of clay at each other. And so you had to have a government intervention there. The vast majority of the licensing is simply anti-competitive to allow people on the inside to charge higher prices to the public. It's a huge barrier, especially for lower income folks who are trying to enter the middle class. There's a great example of how they try to stretch the law. There have been a number of massage cases. Most states have got licensing for massage. And there was a case out in Arizona where some government officials were very upset because people were doing foot rubs, but they didn't have a government massage license. And the other fun thing about massage licensing is that the police are always trying to catch violators. And so if the police would send undercover cops into the massage parlors and offer to pay extra for special services, and then the police get headlines and pretend they're saving people from unlicensed masseuses who are too friendly.
It is such an interesting microcosm of so much of what the state does that on the surface of it, if you don't look beneath the state's own rationale for it, then you'd be satisfied that this is simply public-minded people just trying to do what's best for everybody. It's over and over again. Whatever it is they're doing, even the Fed managing the money supply, that's also in the interest of you and me, Jim. And you get just one little layer beneath it. And you see, and then once you see that, you can never unsee it.
I hope you're right. I mean, the Federal Reserve is a great example. I mean, back when people were voting in the 2020 presidential election, when they were mailing in their ballots, I don't recall people asking for an 18% fall in the value of the dollar since Biden got elected, since Biden took office. But that's what's happened. And the media's tried to sweep it under the rug. This is having a huge impact on the tens of millions of Americans, and especially the us independent contractors.
So let me see. I actually have a list. I wrote a list of things here. I got another one. So I'll try and wrap it up with this one. I got another one. So now we've had, I don't know for how many years, this phenomenon of red light cameras. So we have that issue about drivers being, you know, you can, and incidentally, there's been now a free market response to that because you can track where these various cameras are typically. But you even pointed out something I hadn't known about yellow lights, which is that there are areas that have deliberately shortened the duration of the yellow light for the purpose of raising more revenue from hapless drivers.
Yeah. So federal studies have shown going back at least 25 years that one of the easiest and cheapest way to decrease traffic collisions and fatalities is to lengthen the yellow light at a traffic stop. But what a lot of cities have done is narrow the yellow light to even less than what's recommended so that they can get more money from the automatic tickets that are given by the red light cameras that are run by private companies that rake off a lot of the money. But it's one of my favorite examples of how the government doesn't give a damn about killing people needlessly as long as they get more revenue.
Well, on that hopeful note, well, actually, you know what, Jim? Let's see if I can draw out of you a hopeful note, speaking of which.
Okay.
Because, yeah, I know, they're doggone it, there's a lot of doom and gloom on the Tom Woods Show, but I still feel like I have to leave a glimmer of hope, or I'm trying to do things in my world to help people navigate this hostile world that we're living in. How can we finish this on an up note with so, so much to be down about?
Well, one thing I tried to do in last rites was have a lot of comic relief, because I've heard from people who read my earlier books that they read 10 pages and they get so depressed that they just don't go further. But I mean, there's a lot of good things in this country. There's a lot of good individuals. There are folks who are watching, who are big fans of yours, watching your program, who are supporters of the Libertarian Institute, who are out there fighting for freedom. And we don't need 51%. We just need enough people to push back and change the terms of the fight. And most important, the thing that gives me hope is the quality of American beer continues to improve.
I haven't been keeping up enough, Jim. Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, the Founder Centennial IPA.
Duly noted. Duly noted. Do you remember our friend Jeff Riggenbach?
Yes.
The voiceover guy? So he was very, very much a beer connoisseur. He liked these beers that were, you know, local beers, and he was always interested in trying them. And he did a job for me that it was a very simple job. I just needed a voiceover. He had the greatest voice in the world, Jeff Riggenbach. And he didn't want to be paid. And I thought, well, doggone it, I'm going to pay you somehow. And I found out he loved these kinds of beers. So I found a company that'll send you a huge basket. The greatest beer snob in the world couldn't turn his nose up at this basket. And it was like I had sent him $1 million.
So, well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
So anyway, all right, look, the book is Last Rites, The Death of American Liberty by the great James Bovard. And it is published by the same publisher that published my recent book, A Diary of a Psychosis. It's the Libertarian Institute, Scott Horton's outfit with Sheldon Richman and several others. It is a great organization. It's doing book publishing. It's supporting Scott as he goes around and smashes people in debates and gives talks everywhere. The website is publishing outstanding articles on a regular basis. They are some of the hardest working people out there. And the fact that they are putting out books of this caliber is one of the many reasons to support them. But to heck with them for right now. Let's think about supporting old Jim Bovard instead and go pick up your copy of Last Rights. I'll put it in the description of the video and on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2432. Jim, my cat is well and everything is good in the animal department, so I'm glad finally, 24 hours later, you and I were able to have this conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Thanks so much for your kind words.
Thank you very much, Jim, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.